call an encounter with God, but had an interesting thing that we were taking communion on Tuesday night, and as I began sharing about communion, the Lord started reminding me of the relationship between the table and the altar. And if you remember in Malachi chapter 1, you can see it, and basically what it says is that whatever is offered on the altar is a direct representation of what I've partaken of at the table. So here we are, there's this big banquet table set up in the middle of the room. It was a representation the entire summit that a banquet has been set before us and how we partake of that banquet. And I knew that whatever I partake of that banquet, it's going to be represented at the altar. And I kept thinking about that over and over and over again, and God kept sharing more with me. And when I went up to partake of communion, what was on my heart was partaking of was the cup. And by partaking of that cup and what it represents in the blood, that it is by faith partaking of His nature, His character. The nature and character of Jesus. And I thought about it all evening long, the fellowship afterwards, and just kept running through my mind. And when I went that night and when I went to bed, I kid you not, as my head hit the pillow, I heard the Lord speak to me and say, "Come in the nature and character of my Son." I went, "I don't know how to do that." I woke up the next morning, I fell asleep thinking about it. And I woke up the next morning and realized I didn't know how to do that. In the same way that my earthly father had failed, in the same way that I have failed as an earthly father, I've also failed as a son. And I went, "Lord, I don't know how to come as a son. Not like that. I don't know what that means." And I started thinking about, you know, we partake of the character and nature of Jesus King. We've been talking about authority, and last week talking about taking authority over illness and coming back into that place where we can truly walk in that authority. And so I have an understanding of what it means to partake of the character and nature of Jesus King. I understand and have a revelation of what it means to partake of Jesus Priest as our High Priest when we come in the character and nature and we approach the throne of God on behalf of others in the priestly function. I understand, in a sense, what it is to partake of the nature and character of Jesus Prophet and to speak the words of God when I hear Him speak to me and to be able to speak into one another's lives. We all do that, in a sense. I understand as a pastor what it means to partake of the character and nature of Jesus Shepherd and how to shepherd the flock. Those all have to do with how we deal with one another. Even the priestly function, although we're approaching the throne, it's on behalf of others. King, priest, prophet, shepherd, and all of the other things of Jesus have to do with how we minister to one another on His behalf and in that character and nature. But to come in the character and nature of Jesus' Son is a very personal thing. Wow, God, I don't know how to do that. I know how to approach on behalf of someone else and hear His voice concerning someone else, but to just come as His son or as His child, this is not gender specific, I think you follow what I'm saying, to just come as child of God, to just come as son or daughter, and to come in the nature and character of Jesus' Son, I don't know how to do that. So you get to wrestle with it like I do. I've been thinking about this all week long, and I'm not done yet, but it's God calling me into that very intimate place of Abba Father. And I think we all need to learn how to do that. We get caught up in ministry, get caught up in all of the other things and on behalf of others. And it's not that those things aren't good, but to come as a son or as a daughter and just know that He is your Father and to know that He won't fail you as our earthly fathers have. There are no shortcomings there. There is no lack of grace. There is no lack of mercy. He's always loving us and drawing us up into his bosom. Amen. So that's all I'm going to share this morning. And I'm going to turn this over to Reverend Bruce Christensen. He's been sitting on a message and chewing on one and wrestling with it for a little while now. And I believe that God has given him what he's been looking for, and he's going to come and share with the body this morning. So let's give him a hand as he comes up.
I'm here.
See, all it takes is knowing what to do, knowing how things work, and then lining up with that, huh? I'm blessed already to be here this morning and to get to share this with you, because Julie made salsa yesterday, and when Julie makes salsa, it looks like a Tupperware terrorist at the kitchen. I mean, it's, the salsa is incredible. It's excellent, and so is the mess. It just goes from one end of the kitchen to the other. And normally, the cost of my being able to partake in the salsa is I get to clean up the mess. But because I was working on this yesterday, I didn't have to clean up. So I am already blessed to be here this morning. I don't know if I really have anything new for you today. But sometimes to hear things from another side, another source, another person, or to see things from a different perspective is, there's real value in that. And so maybe I'm just here to look at the elephant from a different side. And maybe help you to see things a little bit differently. I don't know. But I know that like Mike said, I've been wrestling with this for a little while, and so I'm here to share my wrestling with you this morning. Does anybody remember, what happened last week before service began? It was after worship, but before service began. Does anybody remember the word of the Lord that came? Chandra got up and shared. And what she said was that the great physician wants to do surgery on our heart. Is that ringing a bell now? Is that coming back to anybody? Circumcision of the heart. And that my spirit just jumped inside me, or my soul, or something jumped inside of me. And when Mike got up and began his message, it had to do with Joshua and the Israelites crossing the River Jordan. And after they had crossed the river, the very first thing that God commanded them to do was to be circumcised. And we're not talking just circumcision of the flesh. This had to do with the heart. This had to do with a laying open and exposing of who we are to God and allowing Him to accomplish His purpose in us and through us. And it's our hardness of heart. If you remember Lee Eddy when he was here talking about the hardness of heart becomes that veil between spirit and soul that keeps us from being full and complete in the plan of God for our lives and in our relationship with Him and with one another. It's that hardness of heart, that thing that needs to be cut away in order for everything that's supposed to happen. And God will do and use whatever He needs to do and use in order to see that accomplished in our life. But it's not going to happen unless we're willing to let Him into the operating room. Now, I think, honestly, that Chandra brought that word last week, but I think we've been in the operating room for a while. I think this surgery has begun and is continuing. And what's going on, I think, is we get to the part sometimes when maybe we need to hold the wound that's already been exposed, maybe hold it open a little bit so that great physician can cut a little deeper and trim a little more away. And this is just part of that process that we're all on. I remember 10 or 12 years ago, I had to go have my hips replaced because I had arthritic issues in my hips, and I wasn't walking real good, and I wasn't sleeping well because of the pain. There was a lot going on. And so I went to the doctor, and he's telling me his idea of the process, and that is we'll do one hip and you'll heal up from that. It'll take about, a couple, 3 months. And then we'll wait 6 months. And then when you're totally healed, we'll go back and we'll do the other. And I'm thinking, I'm self-employed. I can't afford to do this twice. And I can't afford to be off work. I can't afford to pay for this twice. And what I said to him was just knock me out and then wake me up when I can walk. And that was my idea of this process, how I wanted to see it happen. I think I kind of do the same thing with God. I think we all do. It's like, okay, here we know we need the circumcision of the heart. So it's like knock me out and wake me up when it's over. When I'm all fixed, when I'm all better, then wake me up. But we don't get to do it that way. That's not how it happens. That's not his plan. We have to participate. We have to be there. I remember the doctor asking me in regards to my hips. He said, we can do like a local thing where we block you at the spine where you feel nothing from the waist down and you can watch the surgery. And I'm thinking, dude, are you on crack? What is wrong with you? Why would I want to watch that? No, I don't want to watch that. I don't want to be a part of it. Just wake me up when I'm better. But we don't get to do that. I read this book last week, and I don't remember the name of it, but it was about a guy. He's a neurosurgeon, works on the brain, and he's well educated. I mean, he went to England and studied at Cambridge or Oxford or one of those prestigious schools over there. Trained at Harvard, taught classes at Harvard Medical School and other things. And this guy knows his business. He's one of the top in his field. He knows the brain inside and out. He knows as much as anybody knows how the brain functions, what consciousness is all about. And like many well-educated people and people in the medical field tend not to believe in God because science is their provider. That they've studied, they've learned, that's what they know, that's what they understand, and everything has a scientific explanation to them. And so this guy that knows it all gets an infection in his brain that no one has ever seen before. It's a form of meningitis caused by a bacteria that is essentially impossible. And he goes into a coma, and he's in a coma for 7 days, and they don't have any idea what to do with him. Never seen it before. All of his colleagues are baffled. They have no idea what to do. And the book is basically about his experience in the coma. This infection affected his neurocortex, I think it's called, which is the outer layer of the brain that has everything to do with consciousness. And in his scientific opinion, all he knows about everything is that when this area of the brain is affected and infected like his was, you should have no consciousness. There should be you were, and now you're not. He's in essence brain dead. There is no nothing else. You were, and now you aren't. And yet he experienced consciousness during this coma, and he had an experience of going. He went and saw God. It essentially is the way he described it, and. Then he woke up from the coma, and actually that doesn't have anything to do with what I'm the point I'm trying to make about this, but it was a little disappointing to me that although he acknowledged God in his experience, at the end of it, his recommendation was for us to get involved in meditation, transcendental type meditation, in order to recapture this experience of consciousness that and I was a little disappointed. It's like, man, you missed you miss God in this? Wouldn't you want to go back and see God instead of the experience of the conscious state that he was in? But he did in his sort of try to explain this whole phenomenon. And he was talking about things that happen at a subatomic level. Particles smaller than atoms, the particles that make up atoms, protons and neurons and electrons and quarks or whatever they're called, these itty bitty little particles that there is no way we can see. And they function in this vast sort of sea, and it looks like there's no rhyme or reason to any of it, but they're all made, they're all created to do a certain thing. And when they interact in a certain way, certain things happen. They vibrate in a certain way, and it reminded me of God speaking things into existence. He speaks, and that's all speech is vibration of sound. We hear it, we interpret it, and hopefully we understand what one another is saying. But when God speaks, These things that he made come together in a certain way and at this subatomic level. And when they interact the way God spoke them to interact, things begin to appear. Things happen. Things are created. Us, for example, spoke us into existence. Trees and rocks and things. He spoke into existence, and when everything is functioning the way it's supposed to, creation happens. And creation cries out about the very existence of God. And our identities, the things that the person that we were created to be, that God spoke into us, the life and the nature and the character that God spoke into us. He desires desperately for us to grab a hold of that, to release that to him. That's the circumcision of the heart that we're talking about. All our hurts and wounds and disappointments and whatever that shield us from functioning in that proper perspective, God wants to remove. He wants to deal with that. He wants to put us back into that proper vibration where we're doing the things that we're doing. Because then when we relate together, our relationship together points back to the Father like all creation does. It points back to the Creator of all, the Father of all, the Giver of all, the Lover of all. And we take things from God's creation. Like, and because I said trees and rocks and stuff, I'm going to use those as example. We take trees and rocks and we change them. We alter them. You know, we saw the trees, cut them down, saw them up into boards, and we make houses and furniture and stuff out of them. Or we blast stones, out of a quarry and dress them and shape them and polish them and make buildings out of them or tile floors, marble countertops, things like that. God doesn't seem to have a problem with us altering identities in those ways because the basic identity is still the same. The thing that God created is still what he created it to be, although in a slightly different form. But when we start changing identities in other ways, and I'm going to use rocks and wood again, we have man-made lumber now. Engineered lumber that's better and stronger and straighter and truer than what God made. And we marvel at that and think this is incredible. We made what we're making, what we're creating is better than what God made. And then we've got manufactured stone, you know, we make rocks and fake rocks and stuff out of concrete and in order to build and stuff. And I think God has a problem. I don't think he cares necessarily about engineered wood and fake stones, but when we start creating our own identities, when we start making us, ourselves into things that God didn't create us to be, I think there is a problem, a huge problem. We have these identity issues, and they have come to each of us into our lives for different reasons, like I said, hurts or whatever, they come. And we start thinking about ourselves differently than from the way God speaks about us or thinks about us, and the names that He calls us by change. And this whole thinking about this whole thing, this identity and everything, began for me in this Bible reading that we're doing through the year when we came to the Tower of Babel, and I read that story, and for some reason, I saw it differently than I'd ever seen it before, and it began to mean something different to me than it had ever meant before. And so what I'm doing up here this morning is trying to share that with you. I'll read the scriptures. Genesis 11, 1 through 9, I think. And it says, "Now the whole earth had one language and one speech. And it came to pass, as they journeyed from the east, that they found a plain in the land of Shinar, and they dwelt there. Then they said to one another, 'Come, let us make bricks and bake them thoroughly.' They had brick for stone, and they had asphalt for mortar. And they said, 'Come, let us build ourselves a city and a tower whose top is in the heavens. Let us make a name for ourselves, lest we be scattered abroad over the face of the earth.' But the Lord came down to see the city and the tower which the sons of men had built. And the Lord said, 'Indeed, the people are one, and they all have one language, and this is what they begin to do. Now nothing that they propose to do will be withheld from them. Come, let us go down and there confuse their language, that they may not understand one another's speech.'" And I started looking at some of those words to see what it was talking about here. It said, "Now the whole earth had one language and one speech." So I've always assumed, or we all probably assume, they all spoke the same language. They talked the same talk and walked the same walk. They were communicating on the same level. And that's true to a degree. That word language is sefeth. The implication is language, but the word means lip. Now, you know, we think of automatically lip like this. But the word actually means lip of. For example, take a little container like this, and it has a lip. This is the lip of the container, or a lip of a cup or a bowl or something. And that lip defines what that is. It's the edge. It's the border. It's the boundary of that thing. It makes it what it is. So when it says, "Now the whole earth had one boundary," there was one definition, one lip, one border that was defining the people of the earth at that time, and one speech. Now, that is the word. So yes, there was unity in word, but the unity began with that boundary, that definition, that identity. And it came to pass, as they journeyed from the east, they found a plain in Shinar, and they dwelt there. And they decide to build for themselves a city and a tower. A city is IR. It's a place guarded by a watch. So now we have identity. We have protection. This is the place where all the people are going to dwell together in safety. It's a place guarded by a watch. So we're starting to have... We're starting to see the elements of identity here. Provision, protection, and what's the other one? Identity. Okay. So we're starting to see them come together here. These people are beginning to form for themselves an identity. And then they're going to build a tower. Now, I always think, you know, whenever I've seen that before, you know, tower naturally is something big and tall and you build it up. But I always thought of tower as like the tower you see in an old castle. They put them in the corners and it was a fortified position. And that kind of makes sense when you're talking about a city that's guarded by a watch. that you would put up a tower. But that's not what they're talking about here. This is not a position of defense. The word actually means a rostrum or a pulpit, a place to speak from. So they take this identity, their boundary, their lip, and the word that they use to proclaim that identity, and they build a tower, they build a pulpit to proclaim that identity from. Well, who are they going to proclaim this identity to? Because now the whole earth have one language, one boundary, and one word. So who are they going to tell? I mean, they all know. They're all in agreement. So who are they going to tell? Well, it says we'll build a tower whose top is in the heavens. So we're going to build this pulpit high enough so we can get out there and we can tell God who we are. And I can't tell you how many times I've been guilty of doing that. Telling God who I am. Instead of hearing from Him who I am. So they build this pulpit because they've judged themselves to be all that. And they go up there and they're going to tell God about their honor and the authority that they have. So that He won't scatter them. It's like, look God, we got it all together. We know what we're doing. We got this covered. And we're just here to tell you, essentially, we don't need you. Ever done that? Ever thought that? Consciously, subconsciously, thinking I got this under control? Or maybe I'm just a little ashamed of the way I've been behaving. So instead of asking God for help, I'm just going to leave Him over here because I'm going to figure this out. And when I get it all figured out and I get all cleaned up, I'm going to come back. And then, God, we can have this relationship. I mean, I see all of those elements kind of coming together in this story. And God says, indeed, the people are one. They are united in this definition of themselves. They've determined their own identity. They've agreed upon it. And anything they choose to do together now, they can accomplish. But this isn't a good idea. So He confuses their language. He confuses their boundary, their border, and He confuses their speech. And it's the same word, it's boundary again. And He scatters us everywhere. And we remain scattered to this day. We still don't understand one another. I mean, we can talk to one another, but we don't understand one another. I see the same heart of the Father in this story that I see in the Garden of Eden. When they ate of the tree of the knowledge of good and evil and God drove them out of the garden, I don't see punishment in it. I see His protection of us. I see the love of the Father in this. Drove them out of the Garden of Eden so that they wouldn't eat at the tree of life and live forever apart from Him. And He scattered us at this point so that we wouldn't remain in a condition of our own choosing, a place of our own identity, proclaiming for ourselves who we are. But He scattered us apart so there would not be unity, so that in our desire to have this unity again, we would come to a place of seeking Him. Remember Rodney King? That name ring a bell with anybody? Guy that was pulled over by the police in L.A. was drunk and they were trying to subdue him and apparently they thought it was going to take 11 or 12 of them with nightclubs beating on him in order to get him into submission so they could get him in a patrol car. I don't know what happened, but it was videotaped and it was ugly. Armed police officers beating the guy laying on the ground. And, you know, who knows how much of it he brought upon himself, but it was ugly. And when the videotape was finally exposed and made public, riots broke out in LA. And I remember seeing the helicopter coverage of the riots going on in people dragging a guy out of his truck and beating him in the head and getting him on the ground and then throwing bricks into his head. I mean, it was awful. It was horrible. Buildings burning. It was, you know, all the worst that we are come together in one place, because we don't understand each other. And Rodney King came on the news at one point, his plea has become famous. He said, and I don't know the exact words, but it essentially was, can't we all just get along? And no, we can't, because we don't understand each other. Because for the most part, we still operate in our own identity. We're not flowing according to the vibration that God spoke into our lives. We haven't submitted and surrendered to that. The circumcision of the heart hasn't happened. We're not operating in the proper identity. And there is no communication on that level that's going to bring us to anything approaching unity and common purpose. It's not possible. We see it in politics. You see it everywhere. We can't get along. We don't understand each other. And God is crying out to his creation, let me fix this. But it means you got to get out of the way. You've got to lay down your stuff and let me put mine in. God has spoken over each one of us, made us to be a certain way. And he just wants so desperately for us to come into agreement, to alignment with his identity for us. He's spoken a name over us. He's called us by what he wants us to be. And he's just hoping that we'll get the idea to find out what God says about us rather than continuing to make our own definitions and declarations about who it is we are. And just to show you how personal and how practical and how beautiful and loving and wonderful the plan that God has for not just in us individually, but us as a group is. I did a study on the lineage of Jesus a long time ago, and it's in Matthew, and it starts out and it lists, you know, so and so have begat this one and begat that one, and it's a big long list of names, and normally those are pretty boring, and you tend to skip through them and go on to the good part of the story that's later on down. But God doesn't put names in there for no reason at all. Those names mean things. All through the Bible, when an event would happen, something would happen, they crossed the Jordan and they put up a pile of 12 stones, one for each tribe of Israel, and they put a name on it. It meant something. That name meant something. My name doesn't. Bruce, I saw something somewhere. It was a Scottish thing that means from the thicket or something like that, but, you know, who cares? And to make it even worse, I was adopted. So I was born with one name, which I discovered what that was at a very young age, 4 or 5 or something, 6 maybe. And then I was given another name. So I've got a dual identity here. I got things going on that I really don't understand. And I've spent a lifetime not understanding that I was somebody, but now I'm this other somebody. And so because of my determining my own identity or trying to figure out what this means, I've been double-minded about all kinds of stuff. And it has nothing to do with the name, but it has everything to do with me trying to figure out who I am instead of coming to God and saying, who am I? So I grow up a little bit insecure and shy and stuff because I don't really know who I am. I had a friend years ago. I used to sell upholstery supplies, and it was a guy that I called on over in Chico. And we became really good friends, but I remember him telling me at one point when I first started calling on him, he thought I was a jerk. It's not the word he used. It was a little stronger than that. But he didn't like me. Until we got past that initial judgment, mine of him and his of me, we got past the initial judgment and we became really good friends. But the friendship was based on alcohol and fishing. We went fishing and we drank together and we became great friends, but there's no life in that relationship. There's no future in that relationship. Because of that, it didn't last. Because I came to a point where it was God calling. And I couldn't continue in that. And he was hurt. And we still stay friendly, but there's not that common ground. I wish that God would speak into his heart like he spoke into mine at that time, and that we could come to that unity that God intends rather than the unity that we had before based on things of the flesh and things of the world. Anyway, the names are really important. Not the names that we call one another by, but the names that God calls us by are really important. And I, in the lineage of Jesus, I wrote these out and I just want to share them with you this morning. Abraham. He was first Abram, which means father of height. God changed his name to Abraham, which means father of a multitude, father of nations. And then came Isaac, means to laugh outright in merriment or scorn. And then came Jacob, to swell out or up. We always think of it in terms of to seize the heel, because Esau was born first. They were twins. Esau was born first, and Jacob came out hanging onto the heel of his brother. And Jacob was the usurper, the supplanter. He stole his brother's birthright. And that name, Jacob, means usurper, take by the heel, so supplant, to take something that doesn't belong to you. And I think, what in the world is a name like that doing in the lineage of Jesus? That doesn't make any sense. Because I can understand, you know, father of height, father on high, father in heaven, or father of a multitude, that God is the father of all men, all nations, if we will surrender to him. But what's Jacob? What's usurper? What's heel grabber doing in there? And then I remembered in the Garden of Eden, God turns to the serpent and says to him, I will create enmity. There's going to be a problem between you and your seed and the seed of woman, meaning Jesus. And you will bruise his heel, but he will crush your head. And I thought, well, maybe that's why Jacob is in there, because it's talking about the heel and the attempt to usurp authority, for all time, done by the devil. And then it's even way cool because, Isaac means to laugh outright in scorn. It's like God said, okay, devil, you're gonna try this. Ha! I'll fix you. I'll show you. So he changed Jacob's name, his identity, to he will rule as God. And he's talking about the seed of woman, Jesus, again. He will rule. Then it goes to Judas, to revere or worship with extended hand. Raise your hand in worship. Some of these names may not look familiar because in searching them out, finding the meanings, I would have to go to the Hebrew root. So it says Judas, but the name was Judah. It was one of Jacob or Israel's children. Then there's Pharez, which means breaking forth or to burst out. There's Zerah, a rising of light. There's Tamar, to be erect, a palm tree. Ephraim, to blow on an instrument, to sound the trumpet. Aaron, to rise or to raise, to lift up on high. Aminadab, to volunteer, to offer self willingly. Nathan, to prognosticate or to foretell something, to foreshadow something. It's like prophesying, I guess. Salmon, to resemble. It's a likeness of something. Boaz is an ancestor of David, but it also meant a pillar of strength, but a pillar in front of the temple. Rechab, the mother of Boaz, meant to make room or to open wide. Obed was to become a servant. Ruth was to tend the flock or a shepherd. Jesse was to exist, to be. David, a love token, the beloved. Solomon, to be safe in mind, body, or estate, to make amends, to make restitution. Rehoboam, a people or a flock. Abijah, Jehovah, the self-existent. Asa, the name of a king and a Levite. Josaphat, Jehovah judged. Joram, Jehovah raised. Uzias, strength of Yah. Joatham, Jehovah is perfect. Achaz, to seize or take hold of. Ezekias, to fasten upon. It's the idea of seizing again. Manasseh, to forget, to remit, to remove. Ammon, to build up or to support, to foster as a nurse or a parent. Josias, founded of God. Jeconias, Yah will establish. Sealtiel, I have asked God. Zerubbabel, and this one puzzled me, because all it says is descended from Babylon. But then I looked up the root words, and it meant Zerub, which means flow away, and Babel, which means confusion. So it actually meant like to flow away or be from, away from confusion. Abiud, father of renown. Eliakim, god of raising. Azor, helpful. Zadok, to be right, to cleanse. Achim, Jehovah will raise. Eliud, beauty, comeliness, excellency, glory. Eleazar, helper. Matan, a present, a gift. Jacob, there's this heel planter, heel catcher, supplanter again. And finally, Joseph, to conceive again, or to increase more and more. I mean, there's some pretty amazing identities listed in there. And yeah, they're just names. But if you think about the father's blessings on their children, when they name somebody, it's just like erecting that pillar of stones on the other side of the Jordan. It meant something. There was a reason that it was there. Those names had a meaning. And you have to know that in the lineage of Jesus, no name was selected by accident. That God was actively involved in the choice of every name and the nature of every person that would bring forth ultimately the Son of God. And those names are there for a reason. And I took some liberty and just sort of wrote out my interpretation of the story of those names. I took some liberty here. But I like that the Bible says where the Spirit of the Lord is, there is liberty. So forgive my my taking liberty with this, but this is what I see in the lineage of Jesus. Father in heaven, Father of all the nations and the multitudes, you laughed in scorn at the attempt of the devil to supplant the rule of creation by bruising the heel of the seed of woman Jesus, because he will rule as God. He worshipped you by extending his hands on the tree, and like the blast of a trumpet, light broke forth, and the offering freely given fulfilled the plan that would be like a pillar at the front of the temple, opening the way. The servant shepherd exists to show the love of God by completing the restitution for the people, by making amends for the flock, by providing salvation. He was and is to come, king and priest, judge, raised in perfection to take hold of us with his strength, forgetting what is past, establishing and founding us faithfully as his children. And I was thinking about Mike and knowing, not knowing how to present our offering or to come to God as his children. He wants us to know how to do that. He has asked and continues to ask the Father of renown to deliver us from confusion, to give us the right identity. He is the only help we have to be raised with him in righteousness, and the only help we have to be raised clean with him in his glory. This is the gift God gives us, to be born again, set free from the plan of the devil. I mean, that's God's identity for a number of generations. His idea, the names that he has called those people put together, pointing to his plan for the world and for eternity. Don't you want to be a part of that? Wouldn't you love to hear what God says about you, to know what he's spoken over you, to know who you really are in Christ? It might be painful to think that we have to lay on that table or actively participate in a surgical procedure, circumcising the heart. But I see a picture in this lineage of Jesus of the awesome possibility that we have functioning together in the proper identity. Can you imagine what it should be like? I can't. I can't imagine. But it will be and could be exceedingly and abundantly above anything we could ask or think. And I think God has presented us with an opportunity. He is actually calling us to join in this opportunity to lay down our souls. Let him do what he wants to do. Hear from him who we are, and then see what we can do together. Amen. I think I'm done for now. But I could be back. Thank you, guys.